time. Even given the large number of afflicted with, there are
papers that have been circulated, constituted a reasonable description of what the project was and what its objectives are, and so on. And therefore, that we wouldn't make further presentations now, but throw it open immediately for questions, which we'll try to deal with. So, anybody wishes to?
John Newell, BBC External Services. Can I ask about the scale of the international collaboration and participation, which you are hoping for and planning for with ISIS? I mean, could this amount of a creation of a centre of excellence internationally on the scale of JET?
Well, of course, the whole project isn't as big as JET, so that I think that let's get the scale right. The things that exist are the things that I and others mentioned, the neutrino experiment. They tend to be one-off, almost one-off experimental things. Neutrino experiment, the muon examination, some small Swedish issues, and so on. Now, what we should like to see and what we're working towards is more substantial and formal participation, and discussions are underway with Italy, and with France and with Germany about that. I think that it wouldn't be appropriate to comment any more about those particular things because they are very much underway. There are negotiations in progress, indeed there have been discussions furthering them today. But we would certainly like to achieve as a result of this the sort of participation in the SNS as, for example, exists in the ILL, but extended from that, with certainly Italy being involved. In addition, the ILL, as you know at the moment, is France, Britain, and Germany. And we would also hope that coming out of this, this is a whole part of negotiations, is that we might find ourselves in a position to join the design study phase of the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility. So, I think my colleagues would like to...
Could I add something perhaps about the things that are definite and we've agreed, just to give some scope? Will has mentioned them, but perhaps I'm a good number. First of all, the involvement on the neutrino facility in which Germany has participated is a facility costing £4 million. It's paid by Germany, so it's a substantial involvement. Secondly, Bill mentioned the muon facility, and that is an involvement funded by EEC, by France, and by Germany, and the scale is £300,000. That is a test facility which will take place over 3 years. We have an agreement, in fact it was the first we signed, for neutron use, was with the Indians, in which they provided half a spectrometer, value approximately £300,000. We have not yet agreed, but certainly we have indicated that we are willing to sign it, two further agreements. One is with the Italians to provide a neutron scattering instrument, value £800,000. And we also have an agreement with Germany again, in which they will add a second detector bank to that instrument
worth
£400,000. Now, those are all very specific things.
I've just heard after lunch from Professor Bucci that the Italians have almost certainly agreed to put in about £100,000 to the muon facility. And after this meeting, we're going to talk to a German scientist from Jülich about their probable provision of two instruments for the neutron scattering, each of which will be worth, we haven't decided what they are yet, but somewhere between £500,000 and £1 million each.
One other thing we should add to that is we have really quite advanced discussions with the Japanese about the provision of an instrument, again, value around about £750,000.
Right.
So So there really is a lot of discussion going on. The amount that's formally signed is somewhat more limited, but really a lot of these, one couldn't expect to reach a stage of agreement until one had an active source. We really only had an active source for a short period.
Sorry, could you just repeat, sorry, the figure for the West German collaboration, the first one you mentioned?
The first one I mentioned for the neutrino facility is £4 million.
Paid for by the West
Germans. Paid for by the West Germans.
Thank you very much.
There is, in addition, some very direct industrial interest for one or two about the particular instruments. And we have quite advanced negotiations with British Petroleum, just beginning discussions with Unilever for an instrument. This is very initial preliminary experiments at the scale of £50,000 each over a year or two, just to get things established and to check out the techniques. It will certainly grow if this is successful. And in addition, there's the possibility, which was alluded to in Dr. Manning's presentation, the possibility of this non-invasive temperature measurement of operating internal combustion jet engines, where there is a British company who makes jet engines, who are very interested. And I really shouldn't say too much because it's at an interesting stage of negotiation for them to put money in here to possibly develop this technique.
That's industrial things, not international.
That's industrial, not international. But it's still contributions coming from external sources.
Philip Campbell from Nature. Could you say how you envisage the use of ILL to progress over the next year or two, first? And second, are there any exchange arrangements or international collaboration with countries outside Europe envisaged?
I would expect and hope that the use of ILL would continue as it has over the last few years. It may well be that through our hope for increasing contacts with scientists, for example, from Italy, which isn't in the ILL, there might be collaborative projects that would go forward as combined British Italian, but that's on an informal basis. I think that in the long term, I think a lot of us feel that the ILL should be more available in Europe than it is at the moment. At the moment, it's France, Britain, Germany. And I think some countries resent that. Expressed in a nice way, but and I think we would hope that the influence of the SNS and its Europeanization, that the ILL also could be opened up a bit. We would like to see more partners in some form or other participating in the ILL in the long run. Now, what was the other question?
Second part was non-European. We've already mentioned that we have the first agreement was with India, so that's one. We've also mentioned that we have at advanced stages of discussions with Japan about an instrument, so that's a second one. We have expressions of interest from Australia and also some possibility from other countries, for example China, and in fact I'm about to leave on Thursday to a 2 weeks visit to China and 2 weeks visit to Australia to discuss those possibilities. So there are a number of people who have expressed interest. Not all of these will come to pass, but some of them will surely happen.
As I understand it, this machine is, I'm talking about proton current, 20 times more powerful than argon, which I believe is more powerful in the US. Any interest from the US?
I think it's improbable that there will be direct interest of the form of a formal agreement. I think certainly we will have exchange of scientists. Where's Jack? We have actually carried out a lot of experiments, we should stress this, at American labs at both Auburn and Los Alamos, in which we have investigated things relevant to the SNS. We fully expect that we will continue that collaboration, they will be involved further.
There's a very close scientific collaboration, and there's a lot of very pressing interest from individual US scientists to do experiments at the SNS.
but not at the stage of a formal agreement. I think that's improper.
You know the quote, do you, from the famous article in Nature, which is the best general article on SNS which has been written in for the general scientific public, an article in Science magazine, which was written about 3 or 4 months ago. There's a quote highlighted on the front page of that from an American scientist at an equivalent laboratory, which says, it's a fantastic machine, they're going to blow it out of the water.
There has, Nina Hall, chemistry in Britain, there has been some criticism from certain academics, I won't say who say that the SERC shouldn't be spending so much money on big facilities like Rutherford Appleton Laboratory. I was told earlier this afternoon that your electricity bill is something like £1.5 million a year. Can you justify this when, for example, chemistry as a whole, academic chemistry as a whole, only got £7 million from the SERC?
You're talking to John Albury, aren't you?
No, somebody else.
You could also guess that.
Yeah, I'll start. The £7 million that you quote, of course, excludes stewardships, and furthermore excludes a substantial share of the £600 million put into science departments in universities through the UGC. Point one. Chemists, of course, also use central facilities. It just happens the ones you quote don't. So take part in, here's one by the way, take part in the use of those facilities and hence by implication the money that's gone into them. But if we address the question at a level above the one, not that you put, but the your correspondents have put, I think that there obviously is a serious problem, and there's a problem of judgment as to the balance. Clearly, there are things that you cannot realistically do in a university. I mean, you couldn't, let's assume you want to build it, you couldn't build this in a university easily. There are other things, either from the complexity of the organization or the actual machine itself that you can't. And so there seems to me to have to be in the whole setup a mixture of things which are grants in universities, machines in universities, NMR, infrared and so on, things that universities cope with. And of course the cost of those things these days gets quite high. And I mean a grant of £250,000 is not unusual anymore to university laboratories. But there is also going to be the central facilities. And in my view, the justification of the Council's central facilities is to be able to cope with that. I think that it is entirely right and proper that up to some level the scientists working in those central establishments, some portion of the qualified science and engineers should be partaking of research themselves, A, to ensure good quality staff, and B, to ensure that they are going to make sensible contributions to instrument development for the whole program. So, A, I believe that there is a case for central establishment with these large facilities. B, I feel that the staff should undertake some research up to a point, but clearly they're basically user institutions. Third thing I believe about it all is that the techniques will have been acquired for the main objective, which might be the escalation source, and those techniques might be applicable elsewhere and they can be transferred out of the establishment, as in fact discussed this morning. So, as it were, philosophically, one sees the need for both things, and the argument as to what the right balance is a matter of judgment, and that you, of course, don't build a thing like this without a lot of argument and a lot of judgments. And I think that the root problem, which you've highlighted, is basically the shortage of funds for the council as a whole. I mean, council really should be able to cope with some, I mean, it isn't unreasonably large number of central facilities and an adequate supply of grants to universities. Everyone, of course, uses the figures to suit his case, and the commonest figure quoted is that the percentage of unfunded ALFAs has risen enormously, which is true, and which is, of course, a bad thing, and which we have to do something to improve. The other side of that coin is that the amount of money awarded in grants has gone up 6% per year over the last few years. And, you know, by all normal criteria, that's a pretty good deal. On the other hand, having said that, I'm not arguing that there is no need to improve the grant situation. So I think what you put your finger on is the shortage of funds. There will be people who work a lot with central facilities, who work significantly but less with central facilities, who will fall them, the people who don't work at all on them, and say, well, a pity that that money doesn't come our way. And you're going to finish up with some balance between that.
Did you tell Mrs. Thatcher that there was a shortage of funds?
Of course. And what I believe we should be doing about it is that we should seek partnerships wherever possible, and on the larger things, that probably means international ones, which we've been pursuing very hard, that where the research is in that sort of strategic field spanning sort of basic and development, like the semiconductor business, for instance, we should be pursuing partnerships through with DTI and with industry, and the council has a whole scheme of cooperative awards, which I think could be extended. There probably are things in which we could put our own house in order a little bit. And ultimately, I think that we, if we can satisfy all those things, we should argue for a share in the projected national growth anyhow. But I think that, it seems to me, that's the level we've got to approach the argument. And the scientists have got to get together to make this case and not be sticking knives into each other's backs in the way that sometimes happens.
Could I come in? I think that we have to try to elevate the debate to a scientific level. The requirements of science have to come first. The SERC policy, and a policy which I strongly support as director of RER, is that the preference is to put facilities into universities. If it can be done in a university, put it there. Certainly, the debate that goes on about the program of RAL is not one of we have a certain number of staff, we have to find jobs for them. It is very much that you should decide what science requires, and then we would tell you what the implications are as far as our own position is concerned. And so far, there has not been a problem. The trend that has happened over the last 15 to 20 years has been that central facilities have become necessary because the sophistication of scientific endeavour has meant that the equipment is more expensive. The SNS, people now look at it and say that's an expensive big science facility. It is not. It's an expensive facility, but it's for small science. This laboratory was originally concerned completely with the support of big science. SERC, when it was formed, was almost totally concerned, its manpower, but totally concerned with the support of big science. That has changed in a most dramatic way. That now the majority of the staff are concerned with the support of small science. I believe, personally, as a scientist, that that trend towards more expensive facilities that will have to be provided centrally, or even internationally, is going to continue. It's not a thing that I like to say, but I believe it's the truth. I believe that's what's going to happen. I think that also many people make statements about what has happened in central establishments without really looking at the facts. The facts are that the percentage of SERC money that is spent on establishments, spent through establishments, for supporting university research, not for doing in-house research, for supporting university research, has actually not increased. It has been fairly constant at 30% of the budget. The dramatic thing that has happened is it has all been shifted from the support of big science, biology, physics, and astrophysics, towards a situation where now it supports small science, chemistry, physics, biology. And that is the trend. Now, without any doubt, I completely agree with Bill that the problem we have, and it's a problem in inverted commas, I consider, is that we have more good ideas than we can fund. Now, in a certain sense, that is good news. I would be much more concerned about British science if the position was we had more money than we had good ideas. But it's the other way around. Now that, while it's good news, is not adequate. What we also have to do is to convince the government that we should be given more money. And I think that's a thing we must do collectively. We must do it by a combined action between SERC officials and the universities. One scientific group must stop attacking another scientific group. That does none of us any good. And we must say collectively we want more money.
I could add.
John Turney, Times Higher Education. We were reminded this morning that this is the largest single construction project that SCRC has ever undertaken. Do you think it would be a fair judgment to say this is the last project on this scale SCRC will ever do by itself?
I think if you say this scale by itself, I suspect there's a fair likelihood that that is so.
But not the last ever.
I think that on this scale, it's a question of when you get the partnerships. And one could have said, if you're going to hope for partnerships, you shouldn't even start until you've got them in the bag. I think in the case of the SNS, it probably might never even start that way because of the local situations in different countries not being resolved. And the Germans thought they were building the SNQ, and French were very much involved. So I think this is the way we've had to go on this particular one. I can see that it would be very difficult to start a project bigger than this alone, which I think is the best answer I can give.
In my view, ever in this context is about 10 years. If you think you can forecast anything beyond 10 years, I think you're deluding yourself.
It will depend upon the scientific and national requirements. One should look at the investment that was made in radar just prior to the war. It makes investment that's made in science infinitesimal now. If there is a requirement, it will be invested.
You said that this morning that this facility would have a life into to the next century, until the early part of the next century. In view of the funding, which has been discussed in various ways, what guarantees have you that, what guarantees do you have that the funding will be there to carry out projects so that we get maximum payback on this investment?
Well, I think that we obviously don't have guarantees at all. But I think that, I can't remember exactly who said that, but I mean, I actually believe it, so I'll answer as I said. But I mean, certainly in terms of the science and in an increasing fashion the technology that can be done, I think in that sense one must be talking about 20 years or so. I take Helen's point that we can't really make predictions. Nevertheless, one can make a sort of gut reaction to that. And the way, for example, that ILL is going, the way that the Harwell reactors and their beam tubes are operating effectively and usefully, having been started whatever it was, 1955. So one seems to me, for the work that one would want to do with the machine, one can talk about 20, 25 years. The machine itself has clearly been built so well that it will last that time with patching up here and there. The scope for development exists, so that in terms of the science and technology to be done, in terms of the operation of the machine, with obviously there's going to have to be creative maintenance, as they say.
the funds that we would have to continue to argue for and argue on the basis of now the work which is actually produced. I mean, I think that we certainly have to deliver the goods now. I have no doubts about the ability of the individuals concerned or the machine operating for that happening. I couldn't say that yes, without doubt, I can see that funds are guaranteed for this operation for 25 years. I would think it very, very sad and bad thing if whatever 20 years or so, that were not the case. But nobody would guarantee that.
Okay, could I come in? I think that you have to recognise there are fashions in science. I mean, certain topics are relevant at a given time, and one moves towards it. I think that if you look at the area of science which is supported by the SNS, it is broad, it is fundamental to all modern high technology industry. And hence, I cannot foresee myself that the subject, as a subject to study, is going to be missed out or go out of favour for any modern industrial nation. You can certainly perceive of a country deciding that it cannot afford or does not wish to participate in astrophysics or in high energy physics. I cannot perceive of a country saying that it does not wish to participate in condensed matter research. I'm not saying that I'm in favour of either the further initial statements, I'm just saying that I can at least perceive of that. I think that were the SNS a facility that we had built that was the last of its line with no development potential, then certainly one would be saying its lifetime was 15 years or something like that. But we already have a large number of suggestions about how we can improve it. So I personally would be perfectly willing to bet my own money that the machine will be here, fully utilised, in 20 years' time.
What happens if someone else builds one 10 times more powerful?
Well, the answer is, one says build one 10 times more powerful, that was precisely what the Germans looked at. And they looked at doing this by providing a machine which had 10 times the proton current. And the conclusion was it was incredibly expensive. And I do mean like an order of magnitude more expensive, factor of 10, more expensive than the SNS. Secondly, there were real technical questions about whether it was capable. And thirdly, I believe we can achieve the same result by developments that we can make on the SNS by multiplying the number of neutrons or by improving in other ways. So I personally believe that we have the potential to do anything that is perceived at the moment. Maybe there will be a completely new idea. I can even suggest the direction it might come from. If one can ever get controlled fusion, then as a neutron source, it's superb. But the timescale for that is probably 50 years, and not 10 years or 20 years. So there are ideas, but I think we're a long way off. And I think, meanwhile, we have a lot of development.
And wherever they come from, we're 10 years ahead of them already.
Yeah.
Yes, I think there's a natural timescale for these things. To go by more than a factor of 10 in these sorts of machines is really somewhat foolhardy. We actually did somewhat more than a factor of 10, and we believe that we will get away with it. But the Germans were proposing to go another factor of 20 or 50, even before the SNS had reached full intensity. You would not conceive of starting on a machine increasingly yield by more than a factor of 10, really, until the underlying machine had been working for some time. And you knew all the problems. We still have to learn some of the problems with the SNS.
Can I ask about industrial support? The level of industrial support for basic science basic science is very variable apparently from discipline to discipline. What is the level of interest, if you can sort of integrate across all the disciplines in the SNS, supporting SNS projects from industry? Summarise or particularise or whatever.
Yeah, I think the first point to make is that industry operates on a much shorter timescale than we do. And they're going to be interested when they see what goods can be produced. But we know something about this from the activities of industrial organisations at our neighbours across the road in Hull. The ARE is able to sell about 30 to 50% of its available neutron time. And we are two orders of magnitude better than they are in neutron production. So
but not to put too fine a point on it, we can pinch all their business. Secondly, we are in discussion with a number of industrial organisations now. There are very, apart from the underlying research, the research which is very near to technology but is not directly applied research, the work on catalysts or on new materials, which helps to create the next generation of material. Apart from that, the very direct technological research is very clear for neutrons. It's the study, for example, of residual stresses in materials, the textural studies in strained metals. It's work on the crystallization in glass ceramics or the sediment cements. This kind of thing. We have direct talks with a number of industrial organizations now. Two of them are on the point of investing money into a new kind of instrument, which we're about to build, which is specially designed to look at surfaces, the structure of surfaces. They are proposing to build for us, at the total cost of about 100K, it's not an enormous cost of that, a development project to look at this new area of science, because it's of direct relevance to them, and this will buy them in, apart from doing these other things which will use our facilities. Secondly, there's this new thing, which we didn't foresee when we designed the instrument, of measuring temperatures non-intrusively, non-invasively, in operating engines. You measure the absorption of neutrons by particular elements which are located in particular places in engine components, in rotating turbine blades, in the combustion cavities, in the walls of combustion cavities. You know what happens to those when they blow up? In the walls of combustion cavities, and these kind of things, you can measure the temperature. You can get a temperature map in three dimensions by just passing a neutron beam through an engine without touching, without getting inside it. There is a company which is extremely interested in this, and we're talking with them now. Now, I can't say more because we're discussing with them, but it's a question of judgment, whether it's worthwhile and how much money it's worthwhile investing in this. But the potential is undoubtedly there from underlying science research right through to direct applicability. If you want a figure, I would forecast for you that in 2 or 3 years' time, 5 to 10% of our activity will be directly industrially funded, and that's about right for a facility like this.
There is a general principle which SERC has accepted, and that is that even if a central facility is over demanded by university users, then by right one will provide up to 10% of that facility for industrial use if the demand is there.
So you mean selling it or providing?
Selling it. And that, therefore, that it is accepted that one has a right for industrial companies to enter into it. And we do not believe we will have difficulty in selling out a 10% share.
On a different aspect of industry altogether, I gather that, Dr. Manning, you've been involved in some heavy negotiations at various stages of the project. Would you like to sort of make some provocative remarks about the relative performances of different branches of industry and construction?
No. Is that short enough?
Well, it's not very helpful, but here's okay.
David, would you like to comment in a discreet way? I mean, I think it's a serious question, which should
I mean,
be
why
serious
discreet? It's important, you know.
But would you like to?
I think before one does that, one ought to actually comment on the way in which we built the SMS. Generally, we designed the components ourselves in-house, got industry to make the components to our specification, and then we put them together. On a few occasions, we did actually get industry to design the way in which things should be made to our performance specification. And I think generally, we had more trouble with those components, in general, than we had with the things that we had designed. And the big problem seems to be looked at from our point of view, which may not be from a general industrial point of view, that industry does not appear to be particularly well set up for one-off, highly technological type of provision of components. They tend to be rather segmented in how they organize their affairs and have a design we are used to having a project manager dealing with one specific project right through, and he's the guy who deals with everything. And for our type of work, which presumably is not the main type of work that industry normally does. They do more many-off type of things, where ours are small numbers off. They are not particularly well set up to do that sort of thing, and they are not used to providing a project officer to follow a project through.
But if I can tempt you onto nationalistic sort of grounds, I mean, I gather from CERN that industries from some nations seem to be more willing to respond to the challenge of a one-off project. And, for instance, the British don't seem to be able to do that. I mean, would you like to go to be more specific? Because I do gather that only a fraction of the SNS is, in fact, British construction.
Oh, a large proportion.
But it's not, I mean, let's go around the machine. I mean, let's pick that particular thing. The large dipoles, which is, if you haven't seen them, the yellow components are British. The green quadrupoles that you see were British. The small red quadrupoles, which are physically much smaller in financial terms, were, in fact, Danish. The vacuum chamber, a major development program which I assure you was technically extremely challenging and which we got absolutely superb cooperation, was Irish. The RF system, we had to buy the actual ferrite from abroad, but the rest of the engineering, which is in fact quite a lot, it's conventional engineering, but still a lot of value in it, was predominantly British. What have I missed out?
Well, the control systems,
computers are British. So I would say that more of it came from Britain than from abroad, without any doubt. One other comment I will make about the industrial model. Sure, we had problems with industry. We had contracts that were very late. We had lots of heated debates about it. But eventually, every component that we ordered was delivered. The machine does work. Everything matched the performance we asked of it. Now, you know, eventually you have to judge what you get, and what we've got is, we think, a successful machine.
Any other questions?
Okay, thank you very much.
If anyone would like tours of the SNS who haven't yet had such a thing, do come to the front and you'll find us some guides. If you'd like any interviews too, please let us know.
But now we come on to CF. This, of course, is the proof. Here we see it is of the measurements. All calculations are given by the area lines. Observations of CLO, the time measurements, which cause so much, then the later, all of which general area here, definitely, with a very theoretical model. Here are micro, see some of the preliminary ones, and L that fit quite well, although there's very number there. What does this tell us? The occasion here is that we're wrong on the constant peroxide radicals. But the fact that CO is less here suggests that we've got less OH, because OH is that reacts with hydrogen to regenerate chlorine and then CLO by reaction. So that is sort of in from the slope there. Is important. Calibrations might, and certainly the experimenters, don't seem to be as confident when they get the wrong, when they get in the laboratory, if you get a bad day, don't come out the way you expect, of course, go away and repeat it. From a balloon, you can't ascend, and you tend to pin a lot. But I think that these are some unexplained problems. If we move, the first thing we want to know is really if we're talking about halocarbon ozone depletion. Essentially, it's OH, partition between the chemicals and the species. makes the nitrogen oxide effective in destroying ozone, and the chlorine, OH, makes it more effective. So OH species of OH, we find that we are right. We also find that we need to an awful lot of chemistry. OH is strongly coupled to nitric acid, as we've seen, to HO2, which fortunately aren't important. But we also need to understand the sources and sinks. In other words, understand OH. Not only to understand the process visualised there, water, which is OH in the stratus, the recombination bottom, the intercombination. Now, in OH measurements, we see quite a good state here because the interesting we have Burnett's total column measurements, which have some very variants of seasonal variations, and his column measurements around this particular 10^-13 within about 10% of what you deduce from two measurements of OH. You have essentially tropospheric measurements, mainly by laser induced, and also the function of altitude, Jim Anderson, which fluorescence also. Here you've got an agreement overall column, and point that the are particularly valuable. Function of altitude here, whether you're predicting the profile, the ground-based measure, you're measuring and measuring and measuring, look for seasonal variation and other fluctuation there, and where we can build up a reasonable, because OH is undoubtedly a vital species. And this shows, for instance, how the column are achieved, ones from the elements or from the light chloroform, which is OH in the atmosphere, and then the profile given. So far, we've stuck. Here is the water vapor measure. This does stress the problem. Here are a series of water vapor measurements. People, mainly not measurements. It's got one, I think, that lot. Oh, there's the infrared. Infrared. And the method of Clark. But you can see the structure of the water vapor. But there is a certain in the absolute levels. You get onto a linear scale, you tend to show up as far as problems are concerned. Important to know whether that is or whether that is correct. That makes a factor of two different in the lower stratus, and that would make about 40% different on calculations of the effect bands of nitrogen on stratospheric ozone. This, I think, shows really how the problem changed. I expect many of you have seen this. This is from the end of the cyan, showing the effect of 100 concords had on their ozone. and of 2707 left the drawing, finished on the drawing board on Joko Zone. And of course, one discovery, but one that are actually good for Joko Zone are the effect on the chemistry of in fact, it turns out our improved understanding of the effect of nitrogen oxide, not from nitrogen chemistry, but in fact from the chemistry of this hydrogen radical. Also, for instance, putting chlorine in nature. Now, go on to the next. In fact, it won't show very well. Harwell's slide, this the estimate of continued aerosol propellants at level on stratosphere. And here we start at the top, about 8% ozone amongst estimates. They've got 5%, almost 20%, it's about 12%. If we updated the figure now, down here, somewhere around. And the interesting thing is that the species difference are here, nitrate being put into the model, here, HO being put into the model, and here, pernitrate to NO2. So it's those species, the ones of interest. Can one detect these in the atmosphere? Here we see, for instance, oxide cycle, nitrate is formed for significant, and pernitric acid. And the calculated amounts of pernitric are, this is down about a factor acid, lower down more of this. Now, up these species, piece of evidence that has been picked up by its infrared spectrum, though I'd much rather leave you experts rather than to enter that point. What I want to point out is that if we make measurements of other things, this tells things like can't see chlorine nitrate directly, might see it indirectly. This is a profile, a solid line, calculation of the ratio HF to HC, which are both fairly stable, going from 40 down to the top where they're both rained out. If you're confident from here, will be present as a and bump corresponds to the fact that the is also being transported down is not HCl, which would be it's present as another. And this bump here, 25 kilometers, predicted, the model tells you chlorine there is going to be chlorine nitrate, HCl. Measurement of ratio HF to HCl. Interesting measurements of Farman and Raper. They don't show this big bump with the chlorine nitrate. And this represents another finding out about case speed. Here directly, you can bet on something that you HCl has only about gravitational lines, easy to pick up. Nitrate has many thousands and rather difficult to calibration rotate. That's about the nitric acid. To show you how much we're getting, now these are ratios from and we're getting very nice in general, good this sort of thing. Now, on a slightly cautionary note that comes from the bottom. This is a laboratory spectrum of HO2 radical. Red, this is new vibration, 1100 wavelength. And you can see it's a laser. And these spectrums are taken every 500 seconds. So it's 500 by that scan and that one. The HO2 radicals are A, so the line in there getting steadily weaker across. And this has been done with a double laser. And is that from these experiments we can get out time strengths of a. Now, this is something that one needs to know for a detection of transient. What are the line strengths? And these are calculated theoretically by Komenicki and Jaffe. We find that the line strength of in this band is 8 down on the... I've heard that someone in the state were somewhat similar. I'm not quite criticising, I'm just stressing one has a theoretical calculation of the strength of infrared space that not in general one of the is to calculate for the moment, even for species such as which do has a dipole moment of almost 2 divided. To calculate accurately is not easy. The strength of the infrared is proportional to the square of the dipole moment. The dipole moment is hard. The dipole moment derivative. Then when you square, not surprising if it come off by almost over 10. So I think a useful one is looking for of species in atmosphere. Thank you for your, and I'm looking forward to spending missions talks.
Thank you very much. I must say, I never think of Ron as a rigid chemist. It was a very excellent laboratory thing. Thank you. Over you. Are there any questions?
You implied that the frequencies into your various points very well known.
Yes.
Appropriate implication.
They're better known than the measured rate. That their contribution is only about 20%. But certainly, it's in the lower stratosphere, I agree, are a problem. And too, there are still some problems.
Other comments? Questions? One comment I want to pass off that you do ratio experiments.
Yes.
I don't know if it's going to come up, but John Powell's been doing some deriving OH from his data. Which must be provided to us. Surprisingly, it seems to show accuracy in the range from that ratio.
NO2 to nitric acid.
Nitric acid.
Mm. Well, that's
could
useful.
Be,
yes.
It could be very valuable.
When you get down to it, I mean, what we know is the ratio of NO2. You don't need to know, by the way.
Because it's a measurement which we're addressed.
The other interesting thing about satellites, they may help us sort in the upper stratosphere. And there are problems there. That CLO profile, as you go much above 40 kilometers, is a serious problem. I'll explain that. If you try and explain it, you come up with values for ozone. Well, ozone is something which you...
Sure.
I think just to open... John has said, what we've done is you have nitric acid to NO2. Of course, what we're assuming is the model that the Brian put up there, and we would obviously measurements of NO2, nitric acid, and test them all. So I think there is probably a little bit from the BIT campaign. Obviously, satellite data, but there's enough data to actually test that model. The technique that we're using really is.
Comments, questions?
Yeah, when you show the integrated parts of our network, you said it compared rather well, integrating the individual focus so up to the top of the mesosphere. I thought that was being right, thinking about what that really meant. It was good for the column content. The individual measurements of our troposphere measurement, I'm not convinced it's a troposphere OH yet. That data is garbage. There's no data up at all in the lower strata. And Jim Anderson's data between 60, which is 80% rated profile, even Jim's data is only good to plus or minus 3. So get the integrated column against the column, it looks good to within 10, 20. I think that's a little bit misleading.
That's correct. I mean, I think the proper straightaway methyl chloroform like that. I mean, certainly, I mean, the experiments are suspect because the laser zone, you can actually form OH during the laser.
Any other questions?
You discussed the curve measurements of the world, and they were right. Now mentioning the
well, that was it. Those group of simultaneous measurements. I mean, this is certainly highly important because I've been short of time. It is that the water pressure very real. There's no doubt about. Pi has done experiments. He's measured the down and reproduced between down. Extraordinarily good. The dolphins reproduce beauty. And of course, the interesting, because I mean, what do these in terms of the history of air? And if, is there a correlation between zone, or is there a negative correlation? One could argue there should be either. And this problem, as Bob said, what we don't know about the stratosphere, that is what we, and one good measurement of the stratosphere is small, because it is so long. This is essentially why I was in what's the net ground. There's certainly nothing like a reproducible thing. But what one does is records as well as had taken a particular time, because it's very clear we're getting the lower stratosphere, the more we realise that we need a lot of measurements to get a clear picture of not really the average variability.
Any other questions? If not, well, again, Professor Thrash, you do excellent time keeping it. Next, get on time. Do that. We restarted at 11 o'clock. Dr. Joe Waters is the